Today on Maine Calling, Wabanaki Alliance leader Molly and Brian. Molly and Brian, nay, Molly and Dana, has been an advocate for her people since she was a teenager who was horrified by the prevalence of Indian mascots. She is the former tribal ambassador for the Penobscot Nation. She testified before Congress in November about the plight of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And this month began her new job, executive director of the Wabanaki Alliance, an organization that speaks out for all of the tribal nations located in what we call Maine. Bryant is part of a new generation of Wabanaki leaders, and her approach reflects this. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, a conversation with Molly and Brian. We'll discuss her background and priorities, where she sees the fight for tribal sovereignty. Molly and Brian on Maine Calling, just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The Wabanaki Alliance came together in 2020 to represent the tribes, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, Passamaquoddy, and Penobscot. Stepping into the role as new executive director is today's guest, Molly Ann Bryant. She has been involved in Wabanaki issues and leadership since her childhood on Indian Island. We'll talk with her today about what she hopes to accomplish on behalf of Indigenous communities. Of course, we invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post a comment on Facebook or Instagram. Molly, and welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thanks so much, Jennifer. Great to be here.
You know, I was struck by the fact that the Wabanaki Alliance is 5 years old now. Boy, does time go quickly. You're its second executive director after John Diefenbacher-Krall. What do you see as the role of the Wabanaki Alliance, and what are your hopes for it as you take the helm?
The Wabanaki Alliance has been such a bright spot in so much of the recent attempted changes to a lot of policy around tribal issues in our homelands, now called Maine. And to be able to be involved in something from the very beginning and to take on a different role as we evolve and grow, it's just been such a blessing to me personally. I was able to be the president of the board of directors when we first formed. And the trust and really support from the rest of the tribal leaders on the board that gave me that role of president, I have really carried that through a lot of the work, and I'm just thrilled that they've invited me to serve as the executive director. And the role I see us as having is really educating lawmakers and our friends and allies and neighbors throughout Maine, and being sort of a source of information and a way to empower tribal citizens as we, you know, keep presenting policy. I want tribal citizens to see us as a place to come to learn about these changes and to learn about what we're trying to do with the state. And it's no secret that this relationship between the Wabanaki Nations and the state of Maine hasn't always been great. There's been a lot of confusion and a lack of clarity, litigation at times, a lot of distrust. So having this group, this really moment of unity between the tribes, I think is really important for a lot of reasons. And that information sharing and that empowerment for everyone who comes in our path is really important to me.
I've read that you've said your philosophy is to lead with love in making progress by finding shared humanity. Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah, you mentioned that I got started on a lot of these things as a child, as a teenager. I got really activated to try to work on removing Indian sports mascots from our schools, as we've discussed here before on Maine Calling. And throughout a lot of this work on issues that can be really hard for people, that can stir up a lot of maybe defensiveness or lack of awareness that leads to sort of an anxiety state, the way to cut through a lot of that is to remind people there's a lot of things we all share. Human beings, no matter where we come from, we all feel fear. We all feel like we want to take care of our families. We all feel like we want opportunities in life. And the greatest thing that I found that we all feel that impacts us the most is love. Even when that's hard to find, we all are motivated by the love of our family, ourselves, our people, our country, our state. And even if things cloud that sometimes, I have found that to be such a great unifier. So at times when I'm really frustrated, when I'm not seeing the outcomes I thought we would get, when I feel like the hard work isn't quite paying off, I ground myself in that love for this, you know, these people that have trusted me to make these decisions. And I really think about all of my ancestors before me that didn't have a lot of the opportunities to be heard that I do, and how much they must have loved me without even knowing me to have sacrificed so much so that I could someday speak up and not only be a Penobscot tribal citizen, but know what that means.
You grew up surrounded by people doing the advocacy work, your father, your grandmothers, all in leadership roles. Tell us about them and what you learned from them growing up.
I'm really, really lucky to have had so many people in my family working on advocacy for tribal people. I think a lot of times we can get stuck in feelings of fear and not moving forward and not knowing where to start when things feel unfair or unjust. So my dad, Barry Dana, was the chief of the Penobscot Nation for two terms from 2000-2004. We used to have 2-year terms. And he was involved in a lot of litigation over the Penobscot River. And that's when I started to form a lot of my thinking about what tribal sovereignty means, seeing him wade through those waters, for lack of a better analogy there. And I also saw him working with Passamaquoddy chiefs in some of the litigation that they were in. So I saw also that even if our communities don't always agree on everything, we can come together around things that really matter, and that unity goes a long way. So that really informs a lot of my work at the Wabanaki Alliance. I also, of course, had my great aunt, Donna Loring, very much involved as a tribal representative to the legislature for the Penobscot Nation. She invited me to come testify on some bills as a teenager. And I'll always remember walking into the state house, you know, 15, 16 years old, just feeling in awe of the place and the processes. And I testified in front of the Judiciary Committee on a bill from Passamaquoddy Representative Donald Zaktoma to remove a racial slur for Indigenous women from landmarks in Maine. And that was such a powerful experience in seeing all of these Indigenous women and allies coming together, and that bill passed into law. And I remember thinking, like, wow, it didn't matter what political party people were from or what town they were from. Everybody listened to these stories and made the decision to make progress on this. Even if they didn't fully understand it, they listened to these women. And I was so lucky to be one of them. My grandmothers, my late grandmother Lorraine Dana was our tribal clerk for a long, long time. And I saw her working really hard at the inner workings of keeping our community going. And then my grandmother Elizabeth Sock Beeson was a tribal council member and a director of one of our housing programs. And my mother, Julia Sock Beeson, is a teacher in our reservation school. So she's, you know, taught decades of kids now coming through Indian Island School, and just, you know, the love and care she has for those kids is commendable.
I have to ask you, when you were at the state house with the other women and you were able to get the bill passed about the just horrible name, I'm wondering, how old were you when that happened? How old were you when you had that experience of seeing a law passed that you cared about?
I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
Yep. Really, really impactful.
I can imagine. And now you have a daughter following in your footsteps.
I do. I have 3 daughters. They're 2, 15, and 18. And my 18-year-old is really active with our tribal youth council through Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness. And she's been picked as a national award recipient of an award called 25 Under 25 for an intertribal group called Unity. She's traveled to Washington, D.C. and gone to fancy meetings and conferences already, and super, super proud of her.
Wonderful. I want to talk about some of the things you've been doing recently. In November, you testified before Congress about the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women whose cases have not been solved. What was that experience like, Mollyann?
It was amazing. I've been to that committee a few times before, and Representative Shelley Pingree is the ranking member on that. It's the Interior Appropriations Committee. So this committee oversees a lot of funding for tribal communities. It's Bureau of Indian Affairs, Indian Health Services, and Environmental Protection Agency. So a lot of funding issues go through here. So I've been there to testify a handful of times for the Penobscot Nation about items in the budget. So this time was so much different. It was focused on this one issue, and there were women, Indigenous women from all over the country. I was the only one there from east of the Mississippi. So I'm really happy I was able to go there and talk about our experience here in the Northeast. But it was, you know, a hearing without any like restrictions on how long we could talk. Usually there's a little scary buzzer that will give you a red light if you're getting too close to time and you have 5 minutes exactly. And then there's a structured period for questions and answers. But this was really free flowing. We all had as much time as we wanted to. I think every committee member present asked us all questions and we all gave answers. So it was this really robust, heartbreaking, inspiring discussion about the issues leading to this crisis and perpetuating this crisis. Even though we were from all over the country, there were some very common themes of jurisdictional issues, stereotyping, representation, the silencing and invisibility of Indigenous women leading to this crisis. So being able to connect with these women that I admire so much, telling a lot of the same story and suggesting a lot of the same solutions and being heard by those lawmakers was a really bright spot.
Mollyann, over the years, I've read about this issue, and most of the stories I've read have come out of the Western states. You mentioned you're the only, were the only person testifying east of the Mississippi. Is this a major issue here in our part of the world as well?
Yeah, we have some specific sort of policy conditions that I think we've talked about here before, and it's a big focus of the work of the Wabanaki Alliance. And due to the 1980 Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act, the tribes in Maine are sort of under a different situation from tribes across the state. And this also affects the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis. So this comes down to a jurisdictional issue where in other states, tribes have a more direct relationship with the federal government. But because of this policy from 1980 that our people did, in essence, agree to, we are under Maine jurisdiction in a lot of cases. And a piece of this relating to this issue is the Federal Violence Against Women Act. For many years, even though tribes were mentioned in that act, we didn't have access to it because of some of those restrictions in the land claims. So when we had cases involving domestic violence where the perpetrator was not a tribal member, we weren't able to hear those cases in tribal court. And thanks to two initiatives that we were able to get done, one at a state level with Rachel Talbot Ross and one at a federal level working with our delegation, we did pass a state statute and get mentioned in the federal law. So now we can handle Violence Against Women Act cases of the domestic violence nature in our tribal courts. And that's sort of one piece of the puzzle in that crisis that we've, you know, suffered more from in the past, and we've taken steps to change it.
And how many of these cases are there in Maine of missing or assumed murdered Indigenous women, Wabanaki women?
I probably wouldn't have a good guess on that.
Okay.
It does happen. And I think a lot of us wouldn't know the actual numbers because it doesn't get to the point where it's properly reported or reported.
I can see that somebody leaves and you don't know why. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to talk to you about tribal sovereignty. Last week, we interviewed Congressman Jared Golden and asked him if he would be reintroducing a Wabanaki sovereignty bill in Congress, because he had said that he would be. And he replied that he's working with tribal leaders and that together everyone will decide when the right time might be. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about timing? Is this Congress and this new president likely to support this bill?
I think we're getting the lay of the land. I think Congressman Golden's caution around this topic is probably warranted. When we were able to get that through the House the last time, we obviously have champions in him and Representative Pingree. We were not able to get a senator from our state to be a champion of that legislation. So I think no matter the eventual outcome with the president, which he's already signaling some troubling things for tribal nations. So kind of reading the tea leaves on that probably isn't great. But unless we have a senator from our state willing to champion this and see it through, that's going to be an issue, in the more immediate future, even before that this may get to the president. So I think the congressman was right in his assessment that talks are ongoing with tribal leaders. And we're very appreciative of his effort to keep trying to get federal Indian law applicable to the Wabanaki.
Yeah, speaking of President Trump, he's floated the idea that indigenous people born on sovereign land may not qualify for birthright citizenship. What's your reaction to that statement?
Well, it's extremely troubling. I think nobody saw this coming on his sort of list of things he may do that would be troubling. I don't think questioning tribal citizenship was ever on my mind. So the way it looks, I would hope it wouldn't get to a point where we would have to worry too much, but it does seem to be unfair to use our status as a way to promote some other policy agenda. That also might be troubling for a lot of folks. So I think it's hopefully okay, but I do think it signals some sort of a desire to break down the federal responsibility to tribal nations and to really undermine that relationship.
And I think that Trump's statement does illustrate something that people might be confused by, that, and I'm hoping you can do this for us. Explain how one can be a citizen of a sovereign nation and a citizen of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of the bedrock of the relationship between the tribal nations and the federal government. You had these agreements around taking of land that occurred in the formation of this country, the Dawes Act and the allotments to tribal people. And as the country grew and expanded west, you had a lot of different dealings with different tribal nations. And at one point, you saw the United States government trying to exterminate our people, at a lot of different points, really, in a lot of different methods. And when it became apparent that tribal people not only were going to survive the formation of the United States, but also stay in our communities, you have this series of policies and really the creation of this special agreement between tribal nations and the federal government. And the main thing holding that all together is that we are sovereign nations. And when we deal with the federal government, it's a sovereign to sovereign. So that doesn't mean we just do what we want and have no rules. And especially the tribes in Maine, we don't even enjoy that full tribal sovereignty that other tribes do. That means that we are able to negotiate on a government to government level with the federal government. And that's why you see treaties and policies. And there's a whole block of funding and a fiduciary responsibility that exists in perpetuity because of all the taking of the land and this history that we all share. So that concept of sovereignty is so important in so many ways, and chipping away at that at all is worrisome.
And it was interesting to me. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole doing some research on this, and I was really surprised to learn that Native Americans in the U.S. formally were given or granted, or Congress decided to make it official to give U.S. citizenship in 1924, so only 100 years ago.
Yeah, and then they left it up to the states to extend voting rights after that. And Maine was one of the last states in 1965 to be able to vote in state elections. So yes, that was when we were all sort of made legal or valid, or however you want to put it. And then states had to follow suit individually on a lot of different other regulations.
That's right. I remember Charles Norman Shea returned from his heroics in World War II and couldn't vote in Maine. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, we are speaking with Molly Ann Bryant. If you have questions for her about Wabanaki issues or her mission to lead the Wabanaki Alliance, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. I'm talking with Molly and Bryant, former Penobscot Nation Ambassador and now Executive Director of the Wabanaki Alliance. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us a very brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Representative Aaron Dana, who is tribal representative in the Maine legislature since 2022. He's a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe. Thanks so much for calling in, Representative Dana.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yeah, I think you probably heard that just a little bit ago we were talking about when Congressman Golden might reintroduce tribal sovereignty a bill to the U.S. Congress. And I'm wondering, from the perspective of the state legislature, are we going to see any kind of bill or any kind of movement this session?
Yes, I believe so. I believe Senator Rachel Talbot Ross, former House Speaker, is possibly going to be submitting a bill. She's working on the details and the language right now and consulting with the chiefs to see if this is something that we're going to move forward here at the state level.
All right, so trying to figure that out. Let me ask you, Representative Dana, so this you've served one full term or into a second term. How do you feel it's going? Do you feel as though you are treated with respect, and are you treated, are your ideas heard by your fellow legislators?
Yes. So over the few years and a couple different terms of tribal representatives and tribal ambassadors, we've built an amazing relationship here at the state level with the state legislators. We've been making some crucial steps forward in building those relationships and building support where we came really close with the Sovereignty Bill and Beneficiaries Act this last session. And we've been making some really good strides. We had a two-thirds initially for the sovereignty bill, and then it got vetoed by the governor, Janet Mills, and then it came back to the floor, and we lost a couple votes, which put us under that two-thirds mark. But, you know, all in all, with a great team and a great group of people working together, we have made some outstanding strides here at the state level on building, great relationships on both sides of the aisle and building some amazing legislation that has passed forward and ones that we have struggled with, but we are still optimistic and still looking forward to being successful in these up and coming years.
Great. And Aaron, because we are speaking with Molly in today and we're talking about the Wabanaki Alliance, I'm hoping you can talk to me about what you are hoping for, hoping that the Wabanaki Alliance will be able to do in the years ahead.
Yes. So as you know, and you announced, we have a new executive director, Molly Bryant, and we are looking to keep pushing forward and building those relationships and building strength and get our voices heard down here at the state level. As some of you may know, a few years back between the terms of 2014 and 2018, we actually all had stepped out of the state house. And then since then, we have come back in not myself, but the Passamaquoddy tribe, step back into the state house, understanding the crucial importance of our voices being utilized here at the state level. And after that, the Wabanaki Alliance had formed. And with the Wabanaki Alliance and all of its members and all of its voluntary support, we've made some unbelievable strides and unbelievable success down here on the state level. And I think that's our goal, is to keep moving forward with that momentum and building more relationships and more success here for the tribes when it comes to state legislation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Erin Dana, Passamaquoddy Tribal Representative in the state legislature. Before we move on, Molly, and I have to ask you something. I noticed Erin said Wabanaki, and I've also noticed that your great aunt Donna Loring says the same thing. How do you pronounce the word? Have I been saying it wrong all these years when I say Wabanaki?
No, I think so. It comes from the word Shkwabanakiig, which means people of the dawn, and that comes from our language. So I think, you know, just taking a chunk of that Wabanaki, everyone's going to say it probably a little bit differently. And so the full pronunciation of the native word is Shkwabanakiig. So however we say that part of it, I think is individual.
Okay, good. Wonderful. Well, joining us on the line now is Penobscot Chief Kirk Francis. Chief Francis, thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good morning.
I'm going to ask you a little bit of a personal question before I ask you an official question. I suspect you've known Molly and Bryant her whole life, and I'm wondering if you have anything you would like all of us to know about her and her leadership.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've known Molly and, as you say, most of her life. She grew up across the street from me, and so when she was a baby, we used to see her running around. But in terms of her leadership, you know, I've been fortunate enough to watch her really grow and mature in her leadership roles, and really become very effective in diplomacy throughout the state. She has a real strength with that. She was a great ambassador for our tribe, and again, I'm really proud of the progress she's made, where she's at today, the issues she continues to work on, and the effectiveness that she has in doing it. I'm really proud of Mullian's progress.
And we just heard from Erin Dana. He and Mullian and some others really represent a new generation of leaders. And I'm wondering if you want to reflect on the way that they have chosen to take the fight, the direction, and the way in which they operate. I mean, just the fact that the Wabanaki Alliance is only 5 years old, and the progress that's happened in the last 5 years. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm wondering about your reflections, Chief.
Yeah, so I think, you know, what we're really seeing now with this kind of new wave of leadership and approach is, one, a deep understanding of and extremely educated people around the process, what it takes to get things done, who has to help you do those things. I think we operated so much in silos for so many years that, you know, we finally came to the realization that these issues are really about all of Maine, and that we need to build coalitions and work with others to make them understand kind of why these things are needed. So I think you're seeing a much more focused and educational approach to these issues now, in a way that is extremely enlightening to hear. I mean, when I'm in those rooms, I don't feel like we're disadvantaged in these conversations anymore. I don't feel like we're the experts in the room on these issues, and we've done that in a way with the Alliance to bring a lot of Maine citizens on board and have people talk about, you know, why these issues affect all of Maine, and yeah. So I just think it's a more educated approach now.
You have been speaking up for tribal sovereignty for a long time now. Are you hopeful that it's within reach?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we've as you said, we've made a lot of progress. You know, I understand that my time here as chief is a blip in time, and we're just trying to do our part to keep building the foundation for continued growth. For future leaders to carry on with the fight. So when you say, do I think it's in reach? I do. I don't know, you know, exactly how close, but it's, you know, in terms of total autonomous sovereignty, I think, you know, we have some work to do, but, you know, we are a sovereign tribe. We will always be that. We operate in a self-governing, self-determining way here at Penobscot, as do the other tribes. So we're not asking for anybody to give us sovereignty. I mean, we're really talking about the rightful recognition of it and how that works in practicality. So, I'm optimistic with the work we're doing, and now we've had some kind of posters to hang on the wall the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm. Before I let Chief Francis go, Molly, and anything you'd like to say to him?
Thank you for coming on, Chief, and for the kind words. And I did not ask anybody to ask you that. When this opportunity presented itself to be the executive director, the first conversation I had was with my husband, and the second person I went to was Chief Francis. So I owe you a lot, Chief, for kind of taking a chance on a young-ish, untested person serving a first term on tribal council, wanting to become the ambassador. So I always treasure the trust and the friendship.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know, while I didn't want you to leave, I think we understood what this meant to your growth personally, and the work you're going to be doing is beneficial for us all. So thank you.
Well, Chief Francis, thank you so much for calling into Maine Calling. That was Kirk Francis, Chief of the Penobscot Nation. Molly, before we go to callers that are coming in, I wanted to ask you about something that I've been wondering for a long time now. Way back last October, it seems like so long ago now, President Biden offered a formal apology for the Indian boarding school system. What was your reaction to that apology?
So a mixed reaction, I think. A lot of these gestures and, you know, symbolic measures, I believe they come from a place of really genuine wanting to make things better and wanting to acknowledge a really dark chapter. So just having President Biden take this move and make this speech and travel there, I think a lot of that credit goes to former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is a tribal citizen and was leading the Interior Department at the time. So I like to believe that through her work on producing the report about these boarding schools, that led into this formal action from President Biden. And I think whenever tribal people see gestures like this made or apologies, we want to know what happens next. You know, there's this big trend of land acknowledgments, and sometimes they feel like, okay, we can check that box. We did that. Now move on to our real work or something. But at some land acknowledgments, I feel like they end with a comma. They invite more of a relationship. They invite what comes next. So I think we're in the phase now where, yes, tribal people have always known this dark chapter. We have families and relatives and still tribal people living right now, not much older than me, went to these schools. So this is a very real thing for us. And now that it's sort of its presence in our shared history is validated by this act, I think a lot of us want to know what happens next. And I'm not sure in this administration we will see that clearly, but I know that a lot of good folks stay very present and accountable in that work around acknowledging boarding school history. So maybe we'll come to a place like the work that Canada did, where I believe they actually went through a much more formal truth and reconciliation process around this. But I think that remains to be seen. It feels good, but it also feels traumatic, I think, to have that history out in the open.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned in relation to this, the land acknowledgments that we often hear now, especially when we go to public events. And I was going to ask you, Molly Ann, about those, because I know that you are a big advocate for those. And I do think many of these organizations are earnest and are trying to do the right thing. But it does sometimes feel performative. And I'm wondering if you have sort of mixed feelings about them as well, even though you fought so hard for them for so long.
Yeah, I think you can pay attention to people that walk their talk. And it's really clear when they aren't. So if you go to a fancy glossy event and there's a land acknowledgement, but then there's like, you know, policy in place that goes against the environment or the people in the organization are testifying against tribal sovereignty, or, you know, if the walk isn't matching the talk, that makes it feel sort of inauthentic when they have land acknowledgments. So I think if you're going to do one, great, find out what tribal land you're on, find out what those tribal people are still doing and still up to, and then find a way to be in relationship with them, that deepens that acknowledgement.
Yeah, and you mentioned Canada's reconciliation process. Here in Maine, it has been more than a decade now since the formation of the Maine Indian Tribal Commission and its truth and reconciliation work. And I'm wondering what you think the legacy of that has been.
I think it was such a good movement, and so many great folks were involved. And I think that they, from what I can tell, I wasn't part of that as either on either side of the issue, you know, being interviewed or doing interviewing. But I love that their report really positioned tribal sovereignty as one of their main recommendations, that more self-determination for tribal communities helps heal some of these old wounds. I do hear and hope that the participants in that process feel nurtured and cared for in the aftermath of all of that. So it wasn't just sort of collecting their traumatic stories for this project. And I think that that's happened. I think that the cultural practices involved in that whole commission and the tribal input had a good, you know, outcome, for lack of a better word, throughout these years. So I do think that that body of work stands to benefit all of us for a long time. And it captured a moment in time of folks having to reflect on some really hard stuff. And I hope that they feel it was worth it.
Mitzi found that Wabanaki children enter the foster care system at a rate 5 times the rate of non-Native children, and it blamed underlying racism. And I'm wondering, are those still the numbers here, a decade number, or have those numbers improved?
I believe it's gotten better. You know, we talked about the boarding schools. The main Truth and Reconciliation Commission was looking at those boarding schools as, you know, as a lead into this foster care situation in Maine. So because of, you know, federal legislation that says that Native kids should go to Native families, I've seen our tribal communities and our departments of social services really step up as far as foster parenting and training folks on how to be foster parents and how to get into these adoption, you know, situations and taking in tribal kids. So I have seen an effort to really go along with Indian Child Welfare Act at a federal level. We also passed a Maine version of the Indian Child Welfare Act a couple of legislative sessions ago from Representative Donna Bailey. She sponsored it. So now we have a Maine statute on the books that really encourages keeping tribal kids with tribal families.
Wow, so much more to ask you, Molly, and so many calls coming in, but we do have to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. From tribal sovereignty to online gambling, which we haven't talked about yet, but will. We're talking about many issues with Wabanaki Alliance Executive Director Molly and Bryant. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Mike, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi, Ms. Bryant. Thank you for taking my call. I am the music director and conductor of the Cumberland Community Band. We're 45 amateur musicians, and we play music that you'd probably hear in like a high school band, concert band. One of the things that we have done is we've made a commitment as an organization to buy new works. At least 50% of what we play are from BIPOC composers, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and female composers and arrangers. And one of my ideas that I wanted to throw in front of Ms. Bryant is I wanted to do an Indigenous People's Day concert with musicians, Native musicians who specialize in Native music. That would be like a first step. Ideally, I would love to find a composer and commission a work, because our music that we produce, that we play in, and the instruments we play in is really like, it has a colonial feel to it. Like,
yeah. So Mike, because we have so many calls coming in, I'm going to let Molly in, jump in. Yeah. I'm guessing you're wondering if she has ideas of a composer you could collaborate with.
If I reached out to her, would that be something that she would, you know, would respond to? I've been looking for an organization.
Yeah, for sure. So you can reach out to wabanakialliance.com. All of our contact information is on there. And there are a lot of really talented Wabanaki musicians. I can't think of a composer off the top of my head, but there's drum groups, flute players, singers. I know one person named Firefly. He does some singing mixed with music making and is sort of a cool new sound. So yes, reach out.
All right, there you go, Mike. I'm going to read a couple emails together. An email from Lynn who writes, I remain incredulous that Governor Mills has stymied the tribe's efforts for sovereignty. I've never heard what her block is about this important issue. And David says, I'm disappointed to learn that neither Senators King nor Collins would sponsor Representative Golden's tribal bill. Can you explain what their issue was? So putting you in the position of explaining thinking that is counter to yours, Molly, and what do you know from talking with Governor Mills and with our two senators?
Sure. So, and I don't want to put any of my interpretations on what these folks might actually think, but the pushback that we hear a lot around sort of these bigger changes to the 1980 Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act and the state version, the implementing act, is we don't want to pass too much too fast. We don't want to create confusion. We don't want to create a patchwork of tribal lands versus state lands and which laws are going to apply where. And we don't want to sort of diminish any of the rights of the states because they feel like that's been working for a long time. And because of this Settlement Act from 1980 being sort of considered the law of the land when it comes to Native people, there hasn't been really any development of policy beyond what's contained in this act. That, you know, every time there's a question about how the tribes and the state should interact, everybody goes back to this document, which lays out jurisdictional provisions and different sort of, you know, responsibilities that we have to each other. But really, at the end of the day, every time it's been interpreted, it's favored the state and not the tribes. So, you know, we've worked with Governor Mills on some things. We've passed some amendments to the Settlement Act. Her resistance has been twofold. It's been to the large omnibus sovereignty bills, and then it's been to the sharply focused bills getting the tribes access to federal Indian law. So part of that 1980 act was there's a provision where if the tribes are trying to benefit from a federal law, the state can step in and stop us from doing so. So we've been trying to fix that. And as Representative Dana talked about, that effort was vetoed by the governor, and the larger bills she hasn't supported. And the federal version, Senator King didn't come out publicly to oppose it, but a lot of our people in our coalition reached out to him, and a lot of his responses to them included a lot of the same arguments from the governor. So I think it's, you know, we can easily dispel a lot of those fears by looking at how other tribes across the country are doing things. And when you look at the tribal lands in Maine, it's very, very small. So this thinking of like, if there's tribal laws on one piece of land and state laws on the other, we're talking about very small areas, and we can work these things out. Like I talked about in our understanding of sovereignty, it doesn't mean we do what we want. It means that there's a government to government relationship, and we discuss these laws and we discuss how things are going to go. So we just want to get to that level of having those discussions.
We're going to go to Marilyn, who's calling from Holton. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say how much the Holton Band of Maliseets has contributed to millions upon millions of dollars to the Holton economy, and many, many thousands of jobs as well over the years. And it's my hope, of course, along with many, many others, that the rights and benefits of federal law that is it goes to over 500 of the other federally recognized tribes in the United States will benefit finally, and I hope it will be soon, the Wabanaki nations.
Well, Marilyn, thank you for your call. Molly and an ally in Maryland.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. And I do want to give some credit. Chief Clarissa Sabatis of the Holton Band of Maliseet and Ambassador Zeke Crofton McDonald, they both do a whole lot of work within the town of Holton. And you can see that when these relationships work, they work really well. And the Wabanaki Alliance put out a report that Harvard researchers did for us, spelling out how when tribes have greater access to resources and more self-determination and sovereignty, we can really lift up the towns around us. So you heard Chief Francis talk about making this case for all of Maine. Marilyn really supports that what we feel as well.
Marilyn, thank you so much for your call. Before we run out of time, Molly, and I do have to ask about the sports gambling that's been about a full year now of revenues from the new federal law that allows sports gambling. Anybody who's watched TV recently has seen the advertisements. And I'm wondering how that's worked out. Has there been a significant, has it been a significant source of funding for the tribes? And is it going smoothly?
I think it's going well. So the tribes have partnered with different, outlets to make this happen, whether it's DraftKings or Caesars. And it is going well. I think that we want to look at some of the regulations around it to make it easy to partner with folks and make sure our fees are in line with other places in the country. But I think that was a real win all around. And it's not the most... it's not the subject that people most often want to talk about. I think that some folks get an idea in their head around gambling, and there's certainly some valid validity to those feelings. But it's important to think about when you want to talk about being for tribal sovereignty, that means, you know, us having the ability to make those decisions on which businesses we get into. So yes, that was a bill signed by the governor that we worked out with her that also included some great collaboration and taxation provisions, and it is going well.
We'll go to Bob calling from South Portland. Hi, Bob, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Excellent program as always. I had a comment and a question, and just wanted to say that my experience over the last decade as a privileged white guy fortunately woke me up more to Native American issues, especially in my work with the tribes around climate change and other environmental issues. And as a supporter of the Wabanaki Alliance, I'm really struck by how tone deaf Governor Mills continues to be, and also appreciate representatives of the tribes educating me that I needed to educate myself. It was not their job to educate me to these issues. But with that in mind, I'm struck by this reference earlier to the birthright issue through the Trump administration. And I'm just wondering, I'll do some more research, but if there's resources to educate myself further or action to be taken around that.
Yeah, so this came up towards the end of last week. And of course, President Trump did an executive order to end birthright citizenship that is guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. So I believe that was halted by a judge, and that should be tied up in courts for quite some time. And I think we're going to have to wrestle with how we handle a lot of these executive orders. But part of those arguments, the lawyers questioned the birthright citizenship of Indigenous people because of our connection to sovereign lands and some language, you know, saying that we may be excluded from the 14th Amendment. However, Jennifer referenced the 1924 Citizenship Act that did give us citizenship, which should cancel out any interpretation of the 14th Amendment. So hopefully it doesn't have a huge impact on us, but it is troubling to hear that it's even in the mix.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Bob. I'll try to squeeze in one more question. This is from Rich. What are the current priorities for the Wabanaki Alliance in regards to public policy reform for child welfare, foster care, and youth homelessness? So a big question with just a little bit of time left.
Yeah, as I mentioned, we were able to pass a Maine Indian Child Welfare statute a couple of years ago. So I think that we're seeing that support the work of our social services departments around a lot of this. Just thinking in a very meta way, if we can pass some of these overreaching aspects of restoration of the recognition of tribal sovereignty, that helps all of our programs and all of our abilities to do things. So when you're zeroing in on things like addiction and homelessness and some of these really dark legacies of what our people have been through and continue to heal from, if we empower our tribal governments and our tribal citizens with more self-determination through these policies we're trying to pass, I believe that will those will be tiny ripples in a big pond.
All right. Well, Molly and Bryant, thank you so much for joining us for the hour. Good luck balancing your new job with three kids, two teenagers and a little one. And we hope to have you back on Maine Calling soon.
Thank you.
Molly and Bryant, the new executive director of the Wabanaki Alliance. She was formerly the ambassador for the Penobscot Nation. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to learn about how Maine's restaurant industry is doing. Some very popular restaurants have closed recently, but then also a whole new slate nominated for James Beard Awards. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.